Here is just a quick sprinkle of some of the wrong views of creation that people hold today. We have the evolutionist. The evolutionist believes that the universe suddenly appeared from nowhere, that everything comes from nothing. Or if they reject the everything coming from nothing theory, then they think that the universe has just always been here. Or after that, we have the pantheists. The word pan means all in the Greek, and that's the people that believe that everything that is God. This would be the worldview and the view of God in Hinduism. They believe that the world around us and everything that we experience, everything that's tangible, is merely an illusion. And behind it all is God. God is everything. That's why they bow to each other like this. They're bowing to the divinity in you. And they believe that through meditation and through yoga, you get in touch with this God behind everything. And you can experience the enlightenment that you are, in fact, God yourself, as you are also part of this universe. Then we have a more modern version. We have ecofeminists, and they view creation as the body of Mother Earth. She gives life to all here on Earth, and it is now a woman's high calling, especially a woman's high calling, to defend Mother Earth and her body. Closely linked to that, we now have eco-paganism. And this has manifested itself in conservationist and activist groups who practice eco-magic. And this usually involves spending a lot of time in nature, where you build a connection with nature, sort of drawing out the energy of nature. And one group called the Dragon Environmental Network, they built dragon tree runes, R-U-N-E-S, little charms. And if you wore one of these charms, or you put one of these charms over a tree, a bulldozer wouldn't be able to break it down. And that's how you would protect Mother Earth. These renewed pagan religions aren't so much pantheistic, but panentheistic, which is basically they believe that the earth isn't God, but the earth is God's body and God is the soul that inhabits the earth. That's panentheistic as opposed to pantheistic. But all of these views of creation, as good as they would be for a science fiction movie, are far removed from the picture of creation that we get in the scriptures, and especially from the verses that we have in front of us. Paul, in the verses that we're going to be considering today, is going to show us how a Christian views creation. So let's read verses 19 to 22 together. Romans 8. Verse 19 to 22. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. Paul sheds light for us on the story of creation, and he helps us to understand the situation in which we now find ourselves. Where are we, and why do we experience what we experience? And Paul is going to show us how a Christian views creation by reflecting on creation's present, creation's past, and creation's future. All of these will be found in the verses in front of you. So Paul, in this chapter, has been talking about glory. He's been talking about our hope of glory. We find ourselves as Christians in this world, and because we are following Christ faithfully, we suffer along the way, but we do not suffer in vain. We have this hope which is before us, which drives us, which enables us to be patient. And what Paul's doing now as he continues to focus us upon our glory and our hope is he wants to use an argument from creation. He wants us to put ourselves in creation's shoes, as it were, and appreciate what creation is looking forward to. And if creation is looking forward to the day when everything is made new, then surely we should be looking forward to the day when everything is made new. So that's what Paul is doing in these verses. He engages in a little poetic device where he personifies nature. Now, we know that nature doesn't have a soul, it doesn't have a mind, it's not alive, but in poetic language, you sort of subscribe human characteristics to nature. And so he does that as a way of focusing our mind and a way of focusing our emotions on things that we should be thinking and feeling. So he writes in verse 19, as he personifies nature to help us think about what we should be hoping for, he says, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God." And what's interesting is those words, eager longing, it actually means to stretch out. So you know when you stretch out your neck and you stand on your tippy toes to try and see over the horizon? That's what that word literally means. To stretch out your neck in eager expectation. And so he's personifying nature as having this longing, this expectation, this forward looking towards hope as a way of causing us to think the same way. Now, as we try and think together with Paul about what he means by creation, what does he mean by creation? What's included in that description, creation? Well, you would think, given the language here, that it must be, well, everything that's ever been created. But there are certain things we must necessarily exclude. We would have to exclude all angels and all people for these reasons. The elect angels, what I mean by that is the good angels who didn't fall with the devil. Have they been subjected to futility? No. They're not part of the creation that's groaning, hoping for release from a state of futility. We would also have to disagree. We'd also have to include in that the fallen angels are not looking forward with great anticipation to the day when the glory of the sons of God are going to be revealed. So we would exclude fallen angels. In verse 23, Paul distinguishes for us Christians, saying, well, that's what creation does. And now, as for us Christians, so in other words, from 19 to 22, I've been talking about creation, but excluding Christians. And now in verse 23, I'm going to talk about Christians. And then we would also want to exclude the natural man, the unbeliever. It's the unbeliever. He just can't wait until the glory of the sons of God is revealed. Is that what drives him and is what's what he's looking forward to? No. So what does Paul mean by the word creation here? He's indicating the plants, the animals, the planet itself, ice caps, atmosphere, tectonic plates. Okay, so that's what he means by creation. And there's probably something I need to say, which just because of the day and age that we live in needs to be clarified. Creation is not alive. Creation is not a person. Creation is not a personality. It doesn't actually wait with eager longing. Paul is using a little poetic device here. And the reason I'm stressing that is because in our day and age, with the rise of Wicca and witchcraft and these religions that worship the goddess and Gaia and all of these other notions, they use this verse to say, you see, the earth is alive. We should worship it. And so we need to be very clear how Paul is using language here. He's simply using a well-known device that we will find all over the Old Testament. All over the Old Testament, we hear verses like, and the trees of the field will clap their hands. Do trees have hands? No. Do they clap? No. Okay, it's a figure of speech to say creation is one day going to be set free from the bondage that it's experiencing, and it's going to be remade in a new heavens and a new earth, and joy is going to replace the pain of our present existence. Or like Isaiah 35 verse 1 says this, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. Can deserts rejoice? Can they be glad? No, of course not. But what's interesting about the way in which the Bible uses creation is it personifies creation in order to help you to see what you should be thinking about and what you should be feeling and what you should be looking forward to. It's a device that's being used to point your mind in the right direction. So in Isaiah chapter 35, it's a chapter that's all about God restoring his creation and rescuing his people. And all Isaiah does there is he shows that nature is a co-victim as well as a co-beneficiary. It fell with us and it will rejoice with us when God makes all things new. Paul describes creation's present pains as labor pains. Look at chapter 8, verse 22. He says, "For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now." And why this verse is important is because it describes the way in which we should be understanding the sufferings. If you ask a scientist or someone who believes in evolution, you know, as you analyze the world and you see the second law of thermodynamics at play and you see how things are basically not winding up but winding down, what would you say is the end to which we are heading towards? The great fizzle or the great pop or the great freeze or the great bang. However, it's all going to end depending on your theory of physics. Well, Paul says that the groanings, that the decay, that the death is, it's the pains of labor. It's not going to end in death. It's an anticipation of something fantastic. The new heavens and the new earth. So that every time we feel bad, where do our thoughts go? Oh, everything's just so bad. We're never going to get out of this tailspin. No. When we experience those sufferings, we view them as labor pains. Not the pangs of the death rattle in our throats while we're dying, but labor pains. So already Paul is helping us to think about our environment. He's helping us to think about our suffering. He's helping us to think about our future. And there's just a few words I'd like to draw your attention to as he helps us to think properly about where we are. He uses the word creation. We take that word for granted, but really it is a most important word. Last week I mentioned that 50% of New Zealand is now atheistic. That means they don't believe that this world is a creation. They don't believe that there is a creator. So here is a very important word for us. Creation. That's what everything around us is. Our world and the universe has been put there by God. Everything did not come from nothing. Whenever you look at anything in time or space, it has a beginning. It has a beginning. There is nothing that you can point me to in time or space that doesn't have a beginning. Now, it's this exact way of thinking which the atheist wants to try and put back on the Christian. I don't know if you've ever had any conversations with any atheists or any arguments with people about the existence of God, and you've gone something like this. You know, creation proves there must be a creator. Design proves there must be a designer. And then maybe you've had the question, well, who made God? Anyone ever had that experience? Okay, it's a typical experience. And let me tell you the example of another person who did that, Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell is a teenager. He was a very intelligent man. He'd written 60 books. He was a Nobel Prize winner. And as a teenager, he agreed with this idea that everything doesn't come from nothing. Someone had to put it there. But then he was reading John Stuart Mill, who was also someone who didn't believe in the existence of God, and he found this question, but who made God? And that sort of set the trajectory for him to become an atheist. Because if everything must have a beginning, then surely God must have a beginning. What do you think of that? What would be your response to that attack on our faith? Well, it's a flawed question. It's a question that we must necessarily reject because it has built into it false assumptions. Okay, I think I may have said this to you before. We reject the question. Because questions can be asked in such a way as to corner you. Questions can be asked in such a way that they carry along with them in the question freight, that is baggage, which is sneaking in a bunch of assumptions and lies and false premises which will lead the conversation in a wrong direction. For example, Rennie, have you stopped beating your wife yet? If he says yes, that means he once beat his wife. And if he says no, it means he's still beating his wife. The way that I ask the question forces the dilemma. He can't get out of it. He's guilty either way. So let me show you the problem with the question, who made God? And it's a very easy distinction that we need to keep clearly in our minds. Everything that is part of time and space has a beginning. Does God belong to the category of time and space, or is he eternal? He's eternal. He is spirit. He's not matter. He's not subject to time or space. It's a category mistake. You can ask the who made it question of this category, but you can't ask the who made it category of this category, question of this category, because God is eternal and there are no beginnings. He's not bound by the same things that we find with everything that we presently experience in time and space. So you reject the question. It's like asking, what does blue taste like? It doesn't have a flavor unless you associate it with certain food colorings. But blue doesn't have a flavor, guys. You know, that's a question about sight, not a question about taste. God doesn't have a beginning. He's eternal. And we need to think outside the box. We need to think outside our presuppositions and our experience to recognize that God is nothing like anything we experience. He's unique. He's the creator, not creation. So we reject the question as a category mistake. Secondly, just something else that we observe, even just from verse 19, is that creation is not in an upward spiral of an always perfecting evolutionary curve. Man is just getting better and better and better. You know, we were once slime and then we became fish and then we were walking fish and then watch us go. Look how good we are. Look how amazing we are. We don't kill our children while they're still in the womb. We don't even kill our old people while they're dying on their deathbeds. We don't throw atom bombs at each other. We don't shoot each other with guns. We're just getting better and better and better. Is that the truth? Creation is groaning. We're going down, not up. But in order to properly understand our present, we need to look into our past. And that's what Paul does for us as he goes on in verse 20. He says, "For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope." Paul believes in a literal creation. He believes in a literal fall into sin. He believes in God's literal judgment upon sin, which is the reason for the present state of our world. Why do we die? Why do we suffer? Why is nature out of balance in a place of fierce storms, earthquakes, tsunamis, famines, and plagues? Here is the answer. We've got to go back to the time where creation was subjected to futility, but in hope. In the beginning, God made man and he put him over creation. Creation, when it was first created, was good, not bad. Wasn't full of sickness, disease, and dying. Lions did not tear out the throats of other animals. Wolves did not eat animals while they were still alive. Weeds did not take over the face of the earth. The weather was mild and conducive to growth. We did not die. We did not get sick. We did not get old. The world was perfect. It was good. Creation, as it was originally given, was a gift. It was something that we would enjoy to the glory of God. We were not given the world with all of its good to reject it, to live in some sort of monkish monastery, in some sort of self-denying mode, but to take God's gift and give gratitude and worship to him while we enjoy the gifts that he bestows upon us. It was originally given as a trust to man who was to fill it, to subdue it, and having dominion over it, to expand the borders of the Garden of Eden worldwide. The original potential of nature was given not to be exploited and used by man for self-glorification, but to build a society and a community and sciences and culture to the glory of God. But man sinned, and creation was cursed. And Paul, in chapter 8, verse 20, is of course referring to some of the verses we had read earlier from Genesis chapter 3, verse 16 to 19. And I'll read these verses for us. Adam and Eve have just sinned, and God is now confronting them, and now he's standing as judge, and he is pronouncing judgment upon them. And not only upon them, but we see upon creation as well. And he says, to the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust. And in these verses we see that women would be cursed in the area of their calling, childbirth. Men would be cursed in the area of their calling, working the ground. Sin would affect how men and women would relate to each other, and we have prophecies of male chauvinism and feminism as they would war against each other and try to dominate each other. We see the plague of thorns and thistles now dogging all of our efforts. And the work that we were called to, which should have been bliss, would now be painful. And we would have to work by the sweat of our brows. So after a long life of interrelational strife where men and women cannot get along, while they go about their duties, which are painful and full of trial, it ends in death and you go back to the dust. Futility. Subjected to futility. That word futility is a good word because it's the exact same word that the Greek translators of the Hebrew Bible used when they spoke, you know, the book of Ecclesiastes, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. It's this word futility that they use to translate that Hebrew word. That endless cycle of pain, that endless cycle of death, that endless life under the sun is full of suffering. That's what the book of Ecclesiastes is all about. And your only purpose in life is to know your Creator. There's the story of Ecclesiastes right there. Futility. So then, why do we die? Why do we fight? Why do we suffer? Because we are under a curse. We are living in a world that has been afflicted with God's judgment until he makes all things new. There will one day be a world where there is no pain, no death, and no dying. But that's not the world we're living in now. Why did a God who delighted in his own creation subject it all to death and to decay? He did it in order to save it. That might not make sense to you. He cursed it in order to save it. Think about what God's options could have been right then at the beginning when Adam and Eve sinned. God could have, right then and there, have wiped out the universe. He could have killed Adam and Eve, could have burnt up all of the gifts that he had given to them, started again. But that's not what he did. Instead, God gave a smaller judgment. A judgment of death, but only a death by inches. So that it's true that as soon as you're born, you're dying. But you now are able to live a life of dying for 80 years, where you have the opportunity of interacting with God's creation, seeing his glory displayed through general revelation. Perhaps you'll have an opportunity to hear of Jesus Christ, who has died for you and come to faith. And the new heavens and the new earth will now be populated with Adam's fallen race. Because God didn't just wipe us out then and there. We now die by inches instead of instant death, which was a mercy in the hope that it would one day be remade and we would populate it. It's as if God refused to allow the devil to have the upper hand. You know, the devil took God's creation and said, right, I'm going to try and be clever. I'm going to try and get God to kill his own people. I'm going to try and get God to undo what he's done. I'm going to try and get God to turn his hand against his own creation by making his creation sin against him. And it all looked pretty good. Until the death that Adam and Eve experienced was not instant death, but death over a lifetime with a sacrifice to cover their sins, with a promise saying, one day I'm going to send another man, seed of the woman, who's going to crush the seed of the serpent, and he's going to set us free. And he's going to make all things new. And that second Adam is going to do what the first Adam failed to do. So, it is in Jesus Christ, the second Adam, that we now have a hope. He has come into the world, and where the first Adam disobeyed, he has obeyed. Where the first Adam was not willing to lay down his life for his bride, the second Adam was willing to lay down for his life for his bride, the church. And so what happens is when we become Christians, that guilt, that curse, that sin which hangs over all of our heads, for which we must one day give an account for before the judgment seat of God, Christ comes and he pays our debt in full, so that we are released from the curse of sin and death. So you're going to live forever because Jesus Christ has taken your death and he has broken it by resurrecting from the dead. Well, that leaves us with a few questions. If I'm no longer under the curse, if I'm no longer subject to the law of sin and death, Romans 8 verse 2, why shouldn't I as a Christian now be free from sickness, be free from poverty, be free from affliction, and live a life of prosperity, blessing, and success? If Jesus died to redeem me from the curse and I've been redeemed, why do I still suffer? Why does my business still not do well? Why does my body still fail in sickness? Why do my children die? Why do I still suffer the effects of this life like everyone else who's still not yet a Christian or a believer? Surely there should be something different for me if I've followed the second Adam and I've been freed from the law of sin and death. Let me make two responses to this, because I think that what we have here is a very, very, very important question that needs to be answered. How many people are following prosperity teaching today? If you turn on Shine TV, you will be assaulted with prosperity teaching. That is, Christians that are promising you a happy life here and now, your best life now. Because Jesus just wants to make you a success and make all your dreams come true. That's a load of rubbish. That's not the message of the Bible. So let me give two responses, because what's happening is Christians are, as soon as they go through difficulty, because this is the message that they're hearing, what happens to their hopes? What happens to their faith? What do they think about God when they were expecting good times and the bad times continue? Here are two reasons why, as Christians, even though we are saved, we continue to groan along with creation until that day. Firstly, let me paint you a picture. I want you to imagine a murderer who kills in cold blood. And in fleeing from the police, he flees into a church. And in the church, the preacher is preaching to a congregation, and the criminal is trying to hide amongst him, and the preacher is preaching the gospel. And he says, we're all sinners. We've all broken the Ten Commandments. We all have to give an account to God, who is our judge. But God has been gracious and he has been good, and he has sent Jesus Christ to come and to die. And he has died a criminal's death so that the criminal can go free. And the Holy Spirit takes a hold of this criminal's heart and convinces him of his sin and his need for Christ. And he puts his faith in Christ. And he goes to speak to the pastor afterwards. And he says, pastor, I've done this terrible crime. I've killed someone. And the pastor says, you need to turn yourself in. you need to go to jail. How does that sit with you? Haven't his sins been forgiven? Should he still be punished by the law courts, even though his crimes have been forgiven? And the answer is yes. The consequences for his actions continue, even though they're paid for. Even though they're forgiven in God's courts, that murderer must still go and serve his sentence. Friends, you and I are serving up our sentence. The original consequences of Adam and Eve's sins are continuing. And although all of our sins are presently forgiven, we are still living out the consequences of those original crimes. We're not freed from them yet. There is freedom one day, but not yet. Now, some thoughtful people might want to pursue this, and I'm anticipating that there might be some people out there somewhere who say, but surely we should be experiencing more blessing because we're Christians. And they may be thinking to themselves, what about the Old Testament? Look in the Old Testament and you'll see that there's people who were rich, there were people that were healthy. Listen to the promises of Deuteronomy 28, verse 4 to 6. Blessed shall be the fruit of your womb, and the fruit of your ground, and the fruit of your cattle, the increase of your herds and the young of your flock. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed will you be when you go out. You will be the head and not the tail, and armies will flee in 10 directions when you charge at them. Blessing upon blessing, success upon success. Why do we see it in the Old Testament and not in the New? Shouldn't we expect the same blessing? Now, wasn't Abraham rich? Shouldn't I be rich? This is the sort of arguments that we find in the words of the prosperity teachers today. And here is an answer that I need you to understand. When you think of Israel, you should think of the Garden of Eden. Every time you look at the borders of Israel, you should think of the borders of the Garden of Eden. Because what we have in Israel is a reenactment of some of the blessings, the realities, and the situation of Eden. A place where God dwells with his people. A place where the people had the responsibility of tending it, keeping it, protecting it, driving out the seed of the serpent. It was their task to multiply, to fill it, and subdue it to the glory of God. Israel, like Adam, was under a covenant of works. Do this and you shall live. Now, Adam was under a literal covenant of works, but Israel was only under a hypothetical covenant of works. Israel never could have earned their salvation by being good, and it was through their constant failure that they always needed to be pointed back to the sacrifice. Oh, I sinned again. I need that lamb. I keep sinning. I keep needing that lamb. And so the gospel was being preached to them over and over again. Because God would say, do this and you shall live. And they couldn't do it. So they'd need the sacrifice again. And they'd need the sacrifice again. And they'd need a sacrifice again to ensure that a holy God could live in the presence of the sinful people. But what happened when they continued to sin? What happened to Adam and Eve when they sinned? They were kicked out. And Israel was driven from the land, just like Adam and Eve were driven from the garden. So when Israel sinned like Adam, their blessings were cursed. And they were exiled from God's presence. The outward, tangible, material blessings of Israel were an expression, were part of the whole reenactment of Eden. It was fitting that in a context where God lived in a literal tent amongst his people and people could see a pillar of cloud and fire and glory and people couldn't stand in the Shekinah presence, it was fitting that there should be some suspension of the curse that would that has afflicted this world as Eden was trying to be reenacted. And so what we have is this. Israel, when they looked at their land, they saw their inheritance. The land was their inheritance. The land was like the Garden of Eden, a place where God and his people would dwell together, a place of abundance, a place of riches, a place where if I was good, if I was holy, everything would be blessed. I'd have lots of children, I'd have lots of corn, I don't think they had corn back then, and lots of wheat and lots of other stuff. Okay? But what about the New Testament? Is the land our inheritance? Are we living out a reenactment of Eden? No. We're no longer living in the land. We're no longer living under a theocracy. We're no longer living with God in the midst of his people in a literal tabernacle. We now have, Peter tells us, our inheritance, which is being kept in heaven for you, imperishable, undefiled, and unfading. That we're not living out a reenactment of Eden because we're looking forward now instead of back. We're looking forward to the new heavens and the new earth. We're not under a hypothetical covenant of works where we need to be good so we can learn the gospel and keep going back to the sacrifice because Christ has come. We've moved on. The administration has changed. We're in a different dispensation. Let me read to you what Wayne Grudem says about living in the New Testament. Reflecting on what 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 4, which says, "And your inheritance is kept for you in heaven, imperishable, undefiled and unfading." Wayne Grudem says this. Peter here in verse 4 reminds his readers that in the New Covenant, God's rewards are less material, less physical, and less earthly. There is less emphasis on the present material prosperity as a reward because God is now choosing those who are poor in the world to be rich in faith. James 2 verse 5. The enjoyment of physical health is also less prominent, for though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. There is less emphasis too on freedom from persecution. In the Old Testament, if you wanted to prove that you're being blessed, your enemies were being conquered and they weren't touching you. But in the New Testament, it's different. 1 Peter 4 verse 14, "If you are reproached for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you." Having many children in the New Testament is no longer regarded as a necessary sign of God's favor, because in the New Testament, now both marriage and celibacy are his gifts. Christians should not be dismayed at this relative lack of present material reward, for faith recognizes the new covenant reward as something far greater. And here are some of the new covenant benefits that we get. A present sufficiency for material needs, Philippians 4 verse 19. A present spiritual fellowship with Christ, 1 Peter 1 verse 8. A future inheritance, which is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you. Just as God in the Old Covenant encouraged his people to look forward to the future Messiah with faith, so he now encourages us, for whom the Messiah's coming is a fact about history, to look forward to our heavenly inheritance. And so here is an encouragement for every new covenant believer. We do not lose heart, for this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Basically, what I'm saying is this. If another Christian comes up to you and says, "You should be rich, you should be happy, you should be healthy, and you should be successful, because that's the portion of every New Testament Christian. You should have two things, two big words I want to teach you to throw back at them." You can say, "Friend, that is a case of over-realized and under-realized eschatology." Okay, you want to memorize that? Okay, it's very important. So just so you can look clever as you engage in these discussions, of course. Okay, let me explain what these things mean. Over-realized eschatology. The word eschatology is talking about end things. So let's talk heaven. If you over-realize heaven, it means that you want all of heaven now. I want all of heaven's blessings now. Health, prosperity, freedom from sickness, freedom from demons, everything must be free. That's what heaven's going to be like. And that's what people expect the New Testament to be like. It's a case of over-realized eschatology. But it's not only that, it's also a case of, and ironically, under-realized eschatology, because, hey, weren't they rich in the Old Testament? The Old Testament, there were lots of blessings. Let's live in the blessings of the Old Testament. And they want to live in the Old Testament, but not the new. They want to live in the land of shadows where material blessings were being poured out as a reenactment of Eden. But now that Christ has come, they expect a reenactment of Eden to continue. That's absurd. It's underrealized. They're still living in the Old Testament and they need to move forward to the New Testament. They don't know what time it is. They don't know, they don't realize all of the implications that are involved that we are living in the New Covenant. It's a case of overrealized eschatology and underrealized eschatology. All of heaven now, and they want the Old Testament as well. They want everything except for where they are. Well, Paul moves on in verse 21 to point us to the future of our creation. And he says that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. What I really liked about this verse was the order. Creation participates in our glorification. Normally you would think, okay, the whole world's going to get remade and I'm going to be a part of the creation. No. Man is the top of God's creation, a little bit lower than the angels. And it's when man, those believers in Jesus Christ, are glorified, that creation participates in his glorification. And that's an important emphasis because in the world in which we live today, this eco-movements, they want to put earth before humans, don't they? You know, it's more important to save whales than babies in the womb. Okay, there's an inversion that's gone on. You know, the earth supports all life, therefore earth is important, is more important than human life. And that's a load of rubbish. Creation was created as a gift for humanity. And it will participate in our glorification, not vice versa. God made man his vice-regent over earth, and it was when man sinned, creation was cursed. And when man is glorified, creation will be glorified with him. It is his domain and his dominion. Likewise, creation will now have the hope of deliverance because man will be rescued. And here's the wonderful thing of it. Man killed creation, and it is a man who rescues creation. The God-man. The first Adam brought the curse upon creation. The second Adam, through his obedience, is given the name above all other names, has won the glorification and the building of the new heavens and the new earth as his inheritance. So it's just a wonderful reversal. So if you take the whole story, right at the beginning, the devil tempts Adam and Eve, and God doesn't kill them. It's all working itself out so that the second Adam can come and redeem everything and make it better than it was originally. He will create a world where we cannot die, where Adam could die. A world where we cannot sin, where Adam could sin. And so we will gain more in Christ than we lost in Adam. So one day we will be back in Eden, but a better Eden. And there will be, the head over humanity will still be an Adam, but it will be the last Adam, the God-man, Jesus Christ. And then maybe just one last thing to note from these verses before we conclude. There are many questions with regards to eschatology and when the rapture is going to happen. And what I want you to notice about these verses is that the day of the rapture and the day that earth is glorified is the same day. The day that your body is changed in the twinkling of an eye, that's the day that the world is made new. There's no 7-year tribulation in between. I thought I would just drop that one at the end. Let's conclude. Why do we die? Why do we suffer? Why do things break? Why do things go wrong? Why do we fight with each other? Paul has answered these questions for us, but he's not only told us the why, he's told us the story of how it's all going to end. That there's going to be a grand reversal where man condemned creation, man, through the God-man, has redeemed creation and given it hope once again. And now, because we take the book of Genesis seriously, we understand the world in which we live in. And now it is only those who have hope those who have placed their faith in the Lord Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior will have this hope of being delivered in that final day. So we will suffer, but while we suffer, we do not lose heart, because we experience the pains not as the pains of a deathbed, but as labor pains, which are looking forward to a day of renewal. Let's pray.